values. How valuable is freedom? And the other is, why is freedom valuable? They're both important questions. I will start with the first one, and if I have time, I'll do the second one as well. But if not, I'd like to get the first one clear and understood, and if there are things to battle out about it, I'm happy to finish those battles. How valuable is freedom? A lot of political and social commentary makes it sound as if freedom is extremely valuable. Maybe the most important value. Nothing should be traded for the sake of freedom. A government that limits a person's freedom is considered to be a tyranny and it's completely illegitimate and unjust. Infringing on somebody else's freedom to do as he pleases is considered to be one of the most terrible injuries, moral injuries that you can inflict on a person. Our rhetoric, our talk, makes freedom into an extremely important value. But I think in practice, it doesn't work that way. And I don't mean that some people are evil and take advantage. I'm not talking about crime. I'm not talking about weakness. I mean, when we make decisions of principle about how we ought to act, somehow we trade freedom quite easily, even with conviction that it's the right thing to do. We trade freedom for other things, which are considered to be more important. I want to give you five or six illustrations of this and see if we can agree that my description of these cases is correct, that we really are trading freedom for something else. And then we'll have to think a little bit about what the something else is and what this says about our general values. Let's start with taxes. Income taxes. Most democratic, liberal, I don't mean liberal as opposed to conservative, I mean political entities. Democratic, Western, freedom-oriented societies have an income tax. Many have a graduated income tax. The more money you earn, the bigger percentage of your income is paid in taxes. That means you could have one person earning $100,000 a year who pays $30,000 in tax. Another person is earning $20,000 a year who pays $2,000 in tax. Now, the question is, why is it done that way? What justifies that? Don't forget that taxes are what the government takes from you by gunpoint. It's not a voluntary contribution. You are forced to do this. If you don't do it, you go to jail. Well, I guess the reason we pay taxes is because the government provides us with certain goods and services, and they have to be paid for it. They pave roads, and they protect us with the army and the police force, and they run courts, and the services we all benefit from, so we should pay for them. Good. But then it would seem that one should pay a fair share for the benefit that you get. Now, it's true that rich people tend to get somewhat more benefit from the government than poor people. The garbage collectors have to spend more time outside their house collecting the garbage than they do outside the poor person's house. The rich people use the roads more than the poor people do. If you think of the army as a kind of insurance policy, the premium you pay for insurance depends upon the amount of property that's insured. So the rich guy is getting more servants out of the government than the poor guy. But not 15 times as much. Not 15 times as much. Why is he paying 15 times as much tax? The answer is simple. Because poor people can't pay their share. I took a guy who earned $20,000 and paid two. But there are people who earn $10,000 and pay none. And they're getting the services. So you tax the rich in order to support the poor. That's why the tax is so lopsided. Now, is that justified on the grounds of protecting people's freedom? We say to the rich guy, we're taking $30,000 of your dollars. We don't care whether you like it or not. And we're giving it to other people. This is forced charity. Is this based on the value of freedom? Doesn't sound like it to me. The rich guy's freedom is not being protected here. The contrary is being told, we don't care what you want to do. We'll decide what you're going to do. Now, it's true that this decision is made democratically. We'll talk about democracy a little bit later, Yitzhashem. It's made democratically. That doesn't help. We are discussing now the values of the society. We're talking about whether the society holds freedom to be the most fundamental value. If the society held the freedom as the most fundamental value, then the society shouldn't vote that way. They shouldn't vote to force rich people to pay for the poor. It should be condemned as immoral, just the way we condemn societies that tyrannize their governments that tyrannize their population. This should be regarded as unjust tyranny, and it clearly is not regarded that way. Of course, there is an enormous social benefit in taxing the rich to pay for the poor. First of all, in economics, you have a conception called the marginal utility of money. Not everybody agrees with it, but it works like this. How much is the dollar worth? It depends upon who it's worth to. A dollar to Bill Clinton is worth a lot less than a dollar is worth to me. Because if you have millions and millions of dollars, one more doesn't do much for you. Whereas if you don't have millions and millions of dollars, as I don't have, then $1 could be much more significant. So, the theory goes, if you take dollars from the rich and give them to the poor, you're creating more wealth. The society as a whole has more wealth. Because those very same dollars have gone up in value. They have much bigger value now when you transfer them from the rich to the poor. Okay, maybe that's true. And it's certainly true that if you support the poor, then they are prepared to play their role in society with more faithfulness and probably reduces crime. The society as a whole benefits from supporting the poor. That is to say, the society as a whole benefits from taking away the freedom of the rich in order to support the poor. This sounds very much like you are sacrificing freedom for the sake of monetary value and cooperation. Something like that. Let's take a second example. Food and Drug Administration. I'm driving in rural Iowa on my vacation. And I see a farmer milking his cow. And I think to myself, I have never had milk fresh from the spigot. So I'm on vacation. It's time to have experiences. So I go to the farmer and I say, would you sell me a glass of that fresh milk? Sure. How much? Way from New York, $1.50. Sharp Iowa farmer. So I give him the money and he gives me the glass of milk. And from out behind the bushes come two state troopers off to jail. Why? Because it's a transaction with unpasteurized milk. And you can't do that. It's against the law. Now, why is it against the law? He and I are both adults. We are both engaging in transactions that we understand. Why shouldn't we be free to do that? To make a law that says it's illegal to buy or sell unpasteurized milk is a law that tells me I cannot do what I want to do. What's the reason for it? Because unpasteurized milk is unhealthy. People can get sick. So the government, Big Brother, takes it upon itself to protect the health of the people by outlawing these activities. Does that sound to you like protecting my freedom? Doesn't sound like it to me. Freedom would mean, if I want to buy it and drink, it's my business. Okay, maybe there should be adequate labeling. You know, adequate advertising. It should be put up inside, unpasteurized milk can be dangerous to your health. But after that, there shouldn't be any law against buying and selling it, not if you're interested in protecting freedom. Third example. So far as I know, every democratic country has free secondary public schools. And they're not only free, they're compulsory. You have to go to school. You can school your children at home. But there's a minimum curriculum that you have to give the children. And in every case, it includes literacy. The child must be made literate. Learn how to read and write. Now let's imagine parents who say, all that back and forth lateral motion of the eyes isn't healthy for the brain. You don't develop normally if you're going back and forth like that all the time. You have to be out in the fields and the forests. You have to experience nature. They have their theory. Okay, they're nuts. But isn't democracy all about letting everybody follow their own nuts, you know, nutty ideas? I mean, like, what is that what it's all about? Everybody? Pursuit of happiness, it says someplace. I think I remember when I was six. If the government said that everybody has to learn the saxophone, we would say it's a tyranny and terrible musical taste. At least you can learn the oboe. And we'd be up in arms. Somehow, when the government says every child must be made literate, we fold our cards, you know, and bow to the whip. Why? Who are they to tell every citizen how he has to educate his child? The answer, of course, is that literacy is extraordinarily useful. Useful for the child himself and useful for the society. It will make him much more employable. Fits it to democracy and people have to vote. It's very important they should be informed about the issues that the voting is concerned with. And if you are literate, it's much easier. Well, it used to be much easier. It still is, because if you watch television, you're not informed. You're just propagandized. If you read something, you might get some information. So it's an investment in the citizen's ability to support himself, and it's an investment in the collective decision-making of the society as a whole to require literacy. And that is why they take away the freedom of the parents to decide for themselves whether the child should be made literate. Fourth example. I lived through the integration era in the United States when you had legislation opening up businesses and other such enterprises to all citizens without any discrimination. Now, let's imagine Bill Smith, who lives in Tennessee, and he builds his restaurant. He builds it with his own hands. And he orders and cooks the food and serves the tables and takes the money. It's his enterprise. And he says, I only want to serve blue-eyed people whose last names begin with L. It's my restaurant, and those are the people I'm serving. I don't want to serve anybody else. It's my restaurant. So the state comes in and says, oh, no, no, no. In your restaurant, you will serve whom we tell you to serve. We're telling you who to serve in your restaurant. Gosh, how'd they get away with that? If the state would tell me who I have to entertain in my living room, we would say that's a tyranny, unjust, illegitimate, invalid. Wouldn't stand for it. But when it comes to my store, which is my store, I own it. Then all of a sudden we roll over and play dead. And the steak tells us who we can serve in our store. And don't tell me, but you know, you have to have a license by the state. Since you have to have a license by the state, they can tell you what to do. That all begs the question. The question is it right for them to tell me what to do? Is it right for them to require this for a license? Or are they practicing unjust coercion on me? We're asking a moral question now, not a political question. Now, the benefits of integrated legislation are gigantic. Because to have a group of people in society against whom there's discrimination causes them to be very dissatisfied with their condition in society, and they don't work to cooperate and integrate society, and it encourages people to discriminate in other ways. A tremendous, enormous benefit to society is requiring integration. There's no question about that. But then, what you're doing is taking away the freedom of the owner of the restaurant and telling him, yes, we're going to tell you what to do. At gunpoint. Don't minimize the power and violence of government. We're telling you what to do at gunpoint because we think it's better for you not to have your freedom and to get this kind of result. Final example. This is a little reflection on the concept of democracy. Democracy is thought of as a way of minimizing coercion. Somebody who prizes freedom doesn't want to be pushed around, doesn't want to be told what to do. Of course, if we don't cooperate, then all of our lives will be nasty, brutish, and short, quote Hobbes. We need large-scale cooperative actions. Otherwise, we can't defend ourselves against enemies, and we can't build dams, and we can't drain swamps, and so on and so on. Cooperative activity means we've all got to cooperate on a project. Which project? Well, people don't agree on that subject. Now, if you've solved the question, if you solve the question by a vote, it means that you'll be exercising a minimum of coercion. Because the majority will always win the vote. So there will always be a minority of people who are told to do something against their will. So if you really like freedom, if you think freedom is important, democracy is a way of maximizing freedom in communal decisions. The majority of people will always be getting their way and being able to do what they want to do. I think this is maybe the most important moral argument in favor of democracy. Okay. That's for a direct democracy, where every citizen votes directly on every issue. There isn't such a democracy anywhere in the world. We have what are called representative democracies. We vote for representatives, and they make the laws. Yes, every few years or so, we can vote them out. But in the meantime, they're running the show. In between elections, the government is pretty much the absolute ruler of the country. You have in the United States, if you take together the various branches, you have maybe 1,000 people or so who could be qualified as the absolute rulers of the United States. In between elections, if the government takes a decision and you get a referendum, you get petitions, and you get 260 million Americans to sign the petition against the government's decision, it has no validity whatsoever, no effect, no legal significance, there's nothing. All you can do is wait for the next election. Well, maybe you know, it's going to be all over by the next election. Maybe they decide to declare war. Too bad. According to the American system, they have absolute control. Now, you should ask why that is. Why is it that we don't go back to the old Greek idea of direct democracy? Everybody voting on every issue. So you say, well, come on, that's not practical. Well, it wasn't practical until a few years ago. But today there are very good pattern recognition programs. And they can recognize your fingerprint and segregate everybody by fingerprints. But it's not difficult to get a program where you come home at night and on your computer screen there'll be today's referendum. You know, today's issues, what do we provide? Anyway, you stick your fingerprint there, the yes or no, and you vote. And everybody could vote on every issue. And don't tell me there'll be fraud. So are the dimple chats fraud. And so are frauds in this country. And Mayor Daley in Chicago used to say, remember to vote early and often. The fraud attacks every system of voting. There's no way to avoid fraud. Anyway, leave it to the computer guys. Go get you away. That's foolproof. They'll send you back an email. Did you really vote this way? Like I do with Amazon. Did you really order this book? Okay, is the reason we don't have direct democracy, we replaced it with representative democracy, is the reason because it's just too complicated? Many people will tell you that representative democracy is superior to direct democracy. Why? Well, if you have people paid full time to gather all the necessary information on making intelligent decisions, you'll get better decisions. Whereas if I come home at night and one is on an economic piece of legislation and the other is defense and the other is road building and the other is conservation, I don't know enough about any of those issues to have a well-informed opinion. So you'll get better decisions. Better. Better in what respect? Well, it'll be more efficient, they'll chart the long-term consequences. In other words, they'll be economically superior. They'll pay. That means you are sacrificing freedom for profit. Your freedom to have minimum coercion, your freedom to vote so that the majority always gets its way, that freedom is given up for the sake of decisions that will pay better. Well, that means you're sacrificing your freedom for money, basically. The great range of decisions, the only virtue they have being made by a paid group of experts, or really the representatives aren't experts, they pay other experts to give them the best information, is that you get more efficient decisions. I hope you're sensing a pattern here. In a great many cases, we give up freedom for profit. Now, as I said, I don't regard these as failures. Oh, gosh, look at that. It's just either our logic has slipped or our morals have slipped, and we're really doing things that are terrible. I think the vast majority of people are confident that these are the right decisions to make. If so, then freedom isn't as important as we thought it was. It isn't as fundamental as we thought it was. If we're prepared to trade it for dollars, it can't be morally one of the most important things to protect. Questions up to here? Yeah.
Do you think we define freedom as what the majority always would want? But isn't true freedom when the minority, it's like the same minority every single time, also has the voice? And you're getting a distinction between freedom and anarchy. Because in an anarchic society, there's no law, and you'd be able to buy the unpasteurized milk. But do these restrictions actually maintain freedom to a higher degree?
I don't follow either suggestion. First of all, everybody recites the same formula. Democracy means protection of minority rights. That's just gobbledygook. That's jabberwocky. Democracy has nothing to do with minority rights. Democracy means power is with the people. That's what the word means. Autocracy means there's one person has all the power. Aristocracy means there's a selected group that has the power. Meritocracy means the people with the great scores on their SATs have the power. And democracy means the power is with the people. Power is with the people means that the majority of the people determine what should be done so that the majority should not be coerced by the minority. Minority rights means that sometimes the minority wins out over the majority. That's not democracy. The truth is this, that modern democracies happen also to be committed to protecting minority rights. The majority is in favor of protecting minority rights, and that's why it's written into contemporary democracies. But it has nothing to do with what democracy is. It's with, it happens to be something that democracies care about. You might just as well say, democracy means support for the arts. Because contemporary democracies all have support for the arts. That has nothing to do with what democracy means. It just so happens that contemporary democracies also happen to care about the arts. That has nothing to do with what democracy means. So, the idea of minority rights as a concept is there only if the majority happens to agree that the protection of minority rights is an important thing for the society. Now, you're right. Anarchy is terrible. With anarchy, you know, you can't even get down the block because everybody's driving all over the road. But, in between regulating the whole of life on the one side and having no laws on the other, it's a gigantic middle ground. And I think that abolishing the Food and Drug Administration will not lead to anarchy. Indeed, there's a group of people who are called libertarians who have a different vision of how society should be run. They disagree with all the examples I gave you. They disagree in principle, in moral principle, with all the examples I gave you. There should be no Food and Drug Administration. No. Let every person decide if he wants to drink unhealthy substances. Don't deprive them of the ability to make their own decision. And no, there shouldn't be any legislation telling people how they run the restaurants. Everybody should be free to run a restaurant. And yes, taxes should be pegged as closely as it's practical to the amount of services you get from the government. You shouldn't pay for somebody else's services. Indeed, people's liberty should be preserved, and these social welfare types of institutions and legislation should not be part of the legal structure of society. What's the function of government? To make sure that people play fairly. Yes, you should advertise. And advertise clearly and accurately the product that you're selling. And you shouldn't get unfair advantages. You shouldn't take advantage. You shouldn't steal and all the rest of that. But beyond that, no. Canceling out the social welfare legislation does not lead to anarchy. It leads to a lot more freedom. A lot less government coercion. Yes, that does lead to anarchy. So, I think, so far anyway, the conclusions I've suggested are still correct. Any other questions or comments on what I've said so far? Yeah?
Right.
Now, I just want to mention, for the sake of completeness, there is an interesting, tricky question, how to work it down. If we trade freedom for social welfare, or what some people call utility, how should we look at it? Should we say, well, social welfare is important, and utility is important, it's just that very often, social welfare is important, and freedom is important. And just very often, freedom comes in second. That's one way of looking at it. John Stuart Mill, who is almost universally misunderstood in this regard, John Stuart Mill said, there's only one value, and that is social welfare. There's only one value. Freedom is important only when it protects, when it contributes to social welfare. If it doesn't contribute to social welfare, it has no role. When I went to college, one of the things that every college student in America had to read is John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. Now, they don't force you to read anything, for obvious reasons. And everyone misunderstood it, including me, I misunderstood it as well, that Mill is defending freedom on principle. It was pointed out to me by one of my colleagues who taught political philosophy that there's a complete misunderstanding. After all, he wrote On Liberty and he wrote Utilitarianism 2 years apart. And in On Liberty he says, I recognize only one moral principle, and that's the principle of utility. And when he discusses free speech, why should free speech be protected? Why should speech be free? He says, because if everybody can speak freely, then there'll be open debate on all issues. And if there's open debate on all issues, you're more likely to get at the truth. Got it? That's why you should protect free speech. Because you're more likely to get at the truth. Now try that on somebody in the Civil Liberties Union in the United States. Their principle is entirely different. Speech should be free because it's a fundamental right to say what you like. Who cares whether you get something out of it? Who cares whether it produces anything? It's a fundamental right of its own. These are diametrically opposed conceptions. According to Mill, if what you're talking about doesn't promote any truth, then you ought to squash it. Couldn't defend pornography. You couldn't defend pornography on those grounds, on the grounds that it leads you to a better appreciation of the truth. So, Mill's view was there's only one value, and that value is social utility. And freedom is promoted when it's... he says, the reason the government should get out of your life is because the government is too stupid to make you happy. If the government runs your life, you're going to be unhappy. If you run your life, you're going to be much happier. So therefore, since our goal is promoting social utility, get the government out of people's private lives. That way, you can explain why we give up freedom so often. You can explain it on the grounds that freedom has no intrinsic value whatsoever. When it conflicts with utility, it's conflicting with its own justification, its own base. At any rate, the bottom line is what I wanted to achieve was this minimizing of freedom in this way that social utility plays a much greater role. Okay, now let's talk about why freedom is valuable. Or maybe a better term would be how it's valuable. There are two different kinds of value. There are intrinsic values and extrinsic values. The difference is this. An extrinsic value is something that's valuable because it gets you something else that's valuable. An intrinsic value is something which is valuable for itself. By the way, those two ideas are not exclusive. You could have something that has both types of value. Here are examples. For most people, a pleasurable experience is intrinsically valuable. You ask somebody, why are you doing X? Because I enjoy it. And why are you doing something that you enjoy? What? Because I enjoy it, I told you. I mean, that's reason enough. I don't need another reason why I'm doing something that I enjoy. Enjoyment is a reason in and of itself, period. On the other hand, greenbacks, rectangular green decorated pieces of paper with certain U.S. inscriptions on them. Somebody's piling up more and more and more of those. And you ask them why, the answer will likely be, well, I want to buy such and such, and I need a lot of these to buy it. Which means he wants the dollars for something else. Doesn't want the dollars for the dollars. I mean, maybe he's planning to, you know, wallpaper the wall with the dollars, I don't know, maybe. But unlikely. Now, let's imagine that someone is taking a music course in college, and next Monday he's having an exam on Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. So he's listening to the symphony. He asks him, why are you doing that? He says, well, first of all, I love that symphony. And it's just wonderful, wonderful, thrilling music. Second of all, I have an exam on it on Monday, and I have to know it well. So when he's listening to that symphony, it has both intrinsic value and extrinsic value. He's enjoying it for itself. He would have done it had he had no exam. The other hand, it's contributing to the exam. Had he not enjoyed it, he'd listen to it for the exam. So it has both types of value. Okay, that's the difference in extrinsic and intrinsic. Now, let's ask, what kind of value does freedom have? Does it have intrinsic value, extrinsic value, or both? Well, I think it's obvious that freedom is exercise. I think if we locked you up in a cell 6 feet by 6 feet, your life would be much less valuable. There would be a lot of things wrong in your life if you were locked up in such a cell. Because with your freedom, you do all sorts of valuable things. There's no question that your freedom is a means to other things of value. So freedom certainly has extrinsic value. The question is, does it also have any intrinsic value? I'm going to argue no. I'm going to argue that freedom has no intrinsic value. But let me just make one little clarification before we go on. Don't confuse extrinsic and intrinsic with small and big, or more important than less important. That's not a correct identification. Let's take some examples. Let's take oxygen. Available oxygen. Does that have intrinsic value or extrinsic value? I don't know anybody who lives to breathe. I think we all breathe to live. And let's suppose they give an injection which has a timed release of oxygen into your bloodstream so that you can survive that way for the next 24 hours. Would you care whether you could breathe enough? Yeah. Is a really such a great pleasurable experience? No, I just want to stay alive, that's all. Oxygen, breathing oxygen, is of extrinsic value, but it's very, very valuable. I'd give almost anything to be able to continue breathing oxygen, because otherwise I'm dead. So here's an extrinsic value that's very, very valuable. On the other hand, imagine one bite of chewing. Okay, it's pleasurable. But it's such a small pleasure that even though there's intrinsic value, the amount of value there is so small it's next to vanishing. So don't confuse extrinsic and intrinsic with small and big. Extrinsic means it's valuable for something else, and intrinsic means it's valuable for itself. Now we're going to ask whether freedom has any intrinsic value. Extrinsic it surely has. The question is whether it has any intrinsic value. What a difficult question. How can we attack this question? The only way I know of is this. We're going to try to imagine a scenario with two variations. I'll describe a situation to you, the very same situation, and in one variation there is freedom, and the other variation is no freedom. But everything else is held constant. Now, if freedom has intrinsic value, then the difference between the variations should be very important. You should be able to say, well, this variation is better than that variation. The world is better. The situation is better. It's more valuable. If, as I believe, when I'm finished describing it, you agree that there's no difference between the two of them, no difference in value between them, then it will turn out that freedom doesn't have any intrinsic value. Now, the trick here is to describe the situation so that when you take away freedom, nothing else is affected. Obviously, by taking away freedom, the person goes blind, so then it's going to be terrible because he goes blind. What you want is a situation where you take away freedom and everything else that's relevant stays the same, and then you can measure whether the loss of freedom causes any difference to the situation as a whole. Now, here's my case. Now, remember, I'm making the argument, so I'm inventing the case, and it's my case. I've patented it. So maybe if you change the case, things will come out differently. Then you'll make your argument. But since I'm making my argument, I own the case, so I get to define it as I please. And all I need is one such case. All I need is one case. If freedom has its own intrinsic value, then whenever you subtract it, the value goes down. If I find one case where subtracting the freedom makes no difference in the value, that proves that freedom has no intrinsic value. Okay. My case concerns a hobo. This guy lives at the city dump. That's where he lives. And he eats the 1 to 2 day old food. But it's an American city dump, so the food isn't so bad. Americans throw away lots of good food. It takes clothes from the dump. Lives there for a while, until he decides to go to another city, and he hops a ride on a freight train. And he goes to the next city dump, and he spends some time there. That's how he lives. Nobody knows him. He doesn't know anybody. This is his life. This is his life as he's going to lead it to the end. He's not going to meet anybody on a trip who suddenly make him realize how his life could be different. He'll be inspired. No, it's my story. It's my case. I invented it. This is the perpetual hobo. Now, there's a group of kidnappers who have decided that this guy isn't really a hobo. Nobody lives like that. No, he's really, I don't know, Bill Clinton's half-brother, who's eccentric. And they decided to kidnap this guy and hold him for ransom in the woods and send emails and SMS messages to Clinton and ask him for ransom of $250,000. His half-brother. So they kidnap this guy, and they put him in a hut in the forest, and sending these messages. And Clinton writes back, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't have any half-brothers, leave me alone. Now, let's interview this hobo in the hut. You're all locked up in here. Yes? Are you unhappy? Not really. Are you happy? Not really. Tell us something. What was life like at the dump? Were you happy at the dump? Not really. You're unhappy at the dump? Not really. What do you have to eat here in the hut? Well, the kidnappers give me their 1 to 2 day old food. Which isn't too bad because, they're kidnappers, so they're doing pretty well. But it's, 1 to 2 days old. How's the temperature in the hut? Tolerable. I don't like the dump. Would you like to be free? Not particularly. Do you want to stay in the hut? Not particularly. How would you compare it with your life in the dump? Not the same. Suppose we offered you your freedom. What would you do? I might stay on for another 3 or 4 days, and then I'd probably go. I could stay on for 2 weeks also. Or I could go right away. It doesn't matter too much. Right? Now, he's not free. He's locked up in the hut. He can't go. He's stuck. Now, let's compare. Let's compare his being locked up in the hut and his being on the dump. Is the second any better than the first? More valuable? The world is a better place because our hobo is at the dump rather than in the hut. I frankly don't see any value difference between the two scenarios. Nobody feels any better. Nobody produces more. Nobody's more inspired. There's no more pleasure in one or the other. And because those are all true, there's no preference for one over the other. Let's ask it this way. They're setting up a fund to set this guy free. And they're asking you to contribute to the fund. Let's say they're only short $10 to set him free. And they're asking you for your contribution. Let's suppose right next to you a child falls off his bike and skins his knee. And you know that an ice cream cone would make him feel much better. And you haven't got money for both. So you have to choose between buying the ice cream cone for the child or contributing to the fund to set the guy free. I think the ice cream cone is the better bet. Because the ice cream cone really does some good. The kid's crying and this makes him feel better. Whereas paying to the fund to set the guy free doesn't do any good. Because the world isn't any better. He isn't any better. Nobody's any better. when he's free under those conditions. Now, if that's right, then freedom has no intrinsic value whatsoever. It's valuable only because it is a means to other things that are valuable. If this is right, this has very important consequences. Number one, there are lots of people in the world who suffer restrictions on their freedom. That's true. And many people feel that that's unjust and something should be done about it. But there are many of them, and they suffer various different kinds of restrictions on their freedom. And if I'm going to devote some of my life to promoting human freedom, I'll have to make a decision. How should I make the decision? Some people will tell you, all people are equal, and all freedom is equal, and therefore you should do it blind. Don't be prejudiced, and don't be chauvinistic. All people are equal, and all freedom is equal. According to what I've told you, that's baloney. The question you should ask is, what is this person going to do with his freedom? Because the value of his freedom is determined totally by what he's going to do with it. Now, it's true, if a person uses his freedom to produce some happiness for himself, that's good. That's good, and that has a claim on my concern. I'm not saying that he has to contribute charity to other people. No, I have a concern for protecting human happiness on the whole. But if one guy is going to, with his freedom, is going to go bowling, the other guy is a neurosurgeon who's going to cure people's life-threatening diseases, that should make a big difference. The freedom of the surgeon is worth more than the freedom of the guy who's going to go bowling. All freedom is not equal. Simply not true. Now, we say every day, at least twice, some of us say it more often, a verse, the last verse of Kriyat Shema, which really says these words. It says, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt to be your God. That's why I took you out. I didn't take you out because intrinsically human beings are better off free than enslaved. That's not what it says at all. What it says is, I'm investing in there being a people for whom I am their God. That's why I'm making them free. And if that isn't going to happen, then the investment in the freedom is no longer binding. It's no longer interesting. People have propagandized the Jewish religion as a supporter of universal human rights and universal human freedom. They do this by taking Pesach and Hanukkah completely out of context, either out of overwhelming ignorance or out of cynical political motivation. And sometimes both. When the truth is that if you look at the Jewish religion and you look at Jewish history, God's commitment to human freedom is very, very thin. Okay, he took us out of Egypt with spectacular miracles, but we weren't the only slaves in ancient times. There were slaves before us and slaves after us. God didn't set any of those groups free. Not with spectacular miracles, and not with any condemnation of slavery. And even in our history, only a minority of our national life has been with free, self-sufficient political institutions and our own piece of geography. The majority of our national life has been in exile and quite a bit of it in brutal slavery. So God has no absolute commitment to freedom. On the contrary, what he's committed to is using your freedom for a valuable purpose. And if you aren't likely to do that, then God will support your freedom. And if not, it seems that he has no particular interest in it. Final reflection, and I'll take questions for a little bit. My reflection is this. When you go to Masada, they tell you Josephus' story. Josephus, it turns out, was quite a reliable historian, much to the surprise of our modern archaeological friends who automatically discount anything that's older than their own birthday. And he says that the 900 so last inhabitants of Masada all committed suicide on the grounds that if they aren't free and they don't have their own free political life, then life is no longer worth living. Now, these people are painted as religious zealots, but there's something desperately wrong here, because the Jewish religion doesn't stop functioning when a state ceases to exist. Babylonian exile. For 70 years, when there was no Jewish state, Judaism didn't cease to exist. Nothing in the Torah says that we should have given up or all committed suicide. So, it's simply not true that on Jewish grounds, if you don't have a free political state, that you have to you have to die, or you have to fight to the death to prevent it. Jerusalem, when it was besieged by the Romans, was ruled by a small group of political zealots who said, "We fight to the last man, because if we're not free, it's not worth going on." And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the religious leader of the time, negotiated a surrender of the city, really, with the Romans, in return for certain favors, because he held that the Romans were the instrument of God to change the condition of the Jewish people, and therefore we should accept their rule and give up our political independence. This has a moral for certain political positions that exist today, but I'm not going into that. Amazing job. Also understand. But anyway, that's just a little bit about the Jewish perspective on freedom. Yeah.
I'm not in disagreement with what you just said, but I have a question how that goes along with something else. First of all, or whether or not you recall what I'm talking about, because I don't know exactly where it is. I don't know if it's the Gemara or where, but sometimes when the Romans were, I'm assuming it was the Romans, took some female Jewish slaves, and they were in a boat. You know the story?
Sure.
All right, so they committed. They didn't like splash them first.
No, they jumped into the water. Committed suicide.
And then later on,
it was girls and boys.
Right. Later on,
and the girls asked the boys, "Should we commit suicide?" They said, "We should." So the girls jumped over, and then the boys jumped.
Because they thought if them who would be violated naturally, how much more we would be.
That's right.
So how is this different?
Because there wasn't the question of freedom. Right. It was a question of being made to perform certain Jewishly unacceptable crimes. That's a different matter. That's not losing your political freedom. It's not even losing your personal economic freedom. If a Roman will take a Jew as a slave, God forbid, but a Roman take a Jew as a slave and say, "Listen, I'll treat you decently, you know, I'll just lash you 3 or 4 times a week, you know, and just work and make bricks or whatever it is," right? And so then, there's no reason why you can't do that.
Of course, I agree with you. Do we know whether or not these people on Hamathah knew what was going to happen to them?
That's why I said, if you read Josephus' story, he has there the last speech, because a couple of people probably escaped.
More detail.
Yeah, you can read that.
So they weren't going to end up being like slaves?
They may have or may not have, but that wasn't the argument. The argument was,
but with the people who
better dead than red, you know, as we used to say.
With the people who jumped off the boat, they knew what they were.
Sure. Yeah.
And the people in Masada didn't know for sure.
Can you give an example of the possession of something like that is like intrinsic, like the prep, like
value?
The possession of something that has being something physical?
Yep.
No, not necessarily. Like, because if we're showing how freedom does in that, like, is there anything?
Well, pleasure is an experience. Now, I don't know whether you call that a possession or not, but
you do.
If you mean a possession like a table or something like that?
No, like you say you have a freedom, it's something you have. Like, is there anything you have that you
we say you have pleasure, don't we? I mean, he's talking just now in colloquial English, and you know, you talk that way too. I mean, so I don't exactly what you want. I don't know. Let's see. Personal qualities. It could be that a person values certain personal qualities for their own sake, not because they give them something else, like intelligence. The person says, he enjoys being intelligent.
But what's the value of being intelligent, like, unless you do something with it? Like, isn't it just, like, free?
It could be. I think intrinsic value, I should say this because I don't want to leave you with a false impression. I don't think that pleasure is the only intrinsic value. I think, for example, there are intrinsic moral values. Here's a test that some people use. Imagine the last five minutes of your life. The last 5 minutes. Now, somebody offers you, says, listen, I can arrange it for you that in the last 5 minutes of your life you can do X. What kind of X's would be worth it? Says, I can arrange for you that in the last 5 minutes of your life you can earn $15,000. Fella, you're barking up the wrong tree because it's the last 5 minutes of my life. What am I going to do with the $15,000? You know, nothing. So, that's not worth it for me. And it is, you can listen to the harpsichord solo in the first movement of the fifth Brandenburg Concerto. Yes, that's good. I got it. I'll take it. You know, because that's a fantastically thrilling piece of music. Now, let's imagine this. I've made a promise to someone, and I haven't fulfilled it. And this person says, I'll make it possible for you to fulfill that promise. I think many people would say yes. If you ask me, why are you doing that? And I say, I'm doing it because I promised. And somebody goes on to ask, and why are you doing what you promised? I think for many people, the answer will be, I told you already, because I promised. Promising is a reason to do things, all by itself. It doesn't have to contribute to anything else. Promising can be a stop in the reason chain. I don't need a further reason to do what I promised to do. Just like I don't need a further reason to do what gives me pleasure. Certain things in motivation are the stopping point. They're my original motivations. So, I don't think that pleasure is the only ultimate reason. There may be other ultimate reasons as well. But morality gives you other ultimate reasons. Now, is that having? I don't know. Maybe having isn't the right way to describe ultimate reasons. I don't know. I don't see anything that hangs on it. Whether you call it having or don't call it having, I don't see why that's an important feature here. Yeah.
Cyril, just talking about the case of intrinsic and extrinsic freedom, and your case of the hats. So, can you not say that freedom?